Thank you for having me. And I can promise you, coming from Syracuse, New York, there will be no bird songs. They're still frozen to the branches. So we're hoping that they thaw appropriately soon. And yes, thank you. I will, in fact, be headed down south, so I can not make those jokes any longer. I start July 1st. So if you're around Columbia, please stop by and say hi. And I'm certainly looking forward to spending some time going around the South as well. So hopefully I'll have a place to come visit in Georgia when comes time.
Yes, we'll have many times.
Thank you. Can you see the first slide here full of lots of apples?
Yes.
Oh, good. Yay, technology works. So I'd just like to say I love the idea of this event. More and more, librarianship is about constantly learning and reinvention and doing new things. I'm thrilled that Miguel was presenting today as well. He does really great work. And I think that's a trend that we need to pick up a lot on, because for me, the core of librarianship in public libraries, academic libraries, school libraries, corporate libraries, whatever, the core is really librarians who are constantly learning. We help our communities learn, we help our staff learn, and we must constantly reinvent and learn as well. And so the core of what we do is learning. And that means that we're in the change business, because learning is a changing your view of the world, changing how you see the world works, changing your understanding. And innovation itself is change. It's positive change. But I think that there are lots of myths that go around this word innovation. And I'd like to spend our time together deconstructing that a bit, and hopefully have plenty of time for conversation afterwards. And you may be wondering why I'm beginning with apples, because it's not about learning. It's actually about Central New York. When you hear the word innovation, and when you read a lot about innovation, and when people talk about innovation, often it's these visions of Silicon Valley and TED Talks and lots of glass and steel and people sitting somewhere in cubicles writing apps and such. And I think we developed this set of myths, really a mythology around innovation, that it's crucial, it's important, it's how we're going to move ahead, and it all looks basically like something that needs to be plugged in on a regular basis. So I want to talk a little bit about how we can break down those myths and really show that innovation is broadly applicable to every one of your settings and everything that you do. So why apples? Well, I want to start with a quick story about an innovation that occurred here in upstate New York. We love our apples in upstate New York. I think it's roughly equivalent to the peach fetish that I expect to find in South Carolina and Georgia, right? Because it's not just there's an apple. There are lots of apples. There are tons and tons of apples, different kinds, different varieties, whole different uses. And where I live, within about 30 minutes in any direction, we're surrounded by apple orchards. And there was this one apple orchard, apple farm, in Lafayette, New York. And they grow apples, and they allowed a pick-your-own apple. So people could come in, stop by the side of the road, go and pick a dozen apples, pick a couple of pounds of apples, weigh and pay off and drive off. And over the years, they began doing things like, well, if they're coming, we have some pre-picked apples, and let's sell some apple fritters, and then let's sell some apple bread, and oh, how about pony rides for the kids? And they began expanding from just pick your own apples to sort of this notion that we talk a lot about of ecotourism. That is, people going to pick apples but make a day of it and turn it really into a destination. And what they've recently figured out is that if you take apples and you treat them in just the right way, you end up with vodka and all different kinds of alcohol. And so they began selling, they'd always sold cider, and now they began selling hard cider, which, by the way, if you can get a hold of it, is spectacular. And it's under the brand 1911, because that's when the farm was founded. In 1911, they started selling it at their farm, but then they began selling in local stores and grocery stores, and now they're getting larger and larger distribution systems. They've built these whole distilleries. They've built cafes. They've built a whole sort of area around it. And what's fascinating to me is it is the model of innovation done right. In other words, it's not like they looked at the apple orchard and said, boy, there's an app for that. If only we had an app that people could, I guess like Tinder, swipe whether they like an apple left or right. They really began to say, well, what do? We grow things. We have this whole sort of building mentality, maker mentality is farming, and they really expanded. And the notion was that innovation for them didn't look like electrons and TED Talks. It looked like apples, and it looked like fermentation, and it really built on what they knew, and it built on local talents. And so innovation, and what I'm going to talk about today, is innovation that makes sense, innovation that is grounded in the expertise of your community, and innovation where we can really push it forward. Because, once again, if you're anything looking at the kinds of news feeds I'm looking at, and movers and shakers and all these Twitter, there's this constant push that there's like one definition of innovation, when really there are many, many. And so I'm going to begin in a typical academic way talking about the notion of false equivalencies. So false equivalency, or logic fallacy, means that we think these two things are equal, but they're really not, right? So, you know, in mathematics, 2 is not the same as 3. They are not equal. And we've often, or as I mentioned before, in upstate New York, we know that apples are not the same things as what you buy in grocery stores that are red and they have a skin that is hard to break. Many people don't know this, but you're usually eating what's called a red delicious apple, which was bred specifically for how well it keeps and ships. So it has a hard, tight skin that's hard to bruise. And just because they bred the flavor out of it doesn't matter, because it looks pretty. But if you come up here, and I highly recommend you spend some time in the fall in upstate New York, and you go to Beacon Skiff or many of the other apple orchards, you'll discover that there are some amazing apples: Empire apples, Gala apples, Honeycrisp apples. And each one of them has this really different character. And knowing that, knowing within your local area that you can pick something that really appeals to you. Some people like it tart, some people like it sweet, some people like it mushy. No one likes it mushy. But anyway, the people, different textures and such. This idea that there's a false equivalency, that all innovation looks like Silicon Valley, is false. All apples are the same is false. And there's one logical fallacy that we hit over and over and over again. And it's called the fallacy of composition. And it goes something that when one infers that something is true of the whole from the fact that it's true of some part of the whole. Boy, I know that's great, great. Glad we got a professor to come in and read really complex words that don't matter. But what it means is, if you see a fish in the ocean, you assume that everything is in the ocean. And if you're a comic book guy like me, you know that's not true, because Aquaman lives in the ocean. And Aquaman is not a fish. Aquaman is not actually a very good superhero, but the point being here, and I went old school on Aquaman, you'll notice. I, back in Super Friend days, that's my Aquaman, right? This idea that we talk about the notion, oh, I see Steve Thomas is here. Steve will appreciate that comment. The notion here that just because you see an innovation that occurred in one library, that somehow it's going to magically work in every library, or it's going to be the same in every library, or that innovation even has the same character. We're going to talk in a moment. Well, let's go through some of these false equivalencies I want to cover today. The first is the notion that innovation equals big invention, that innovation is somehow this magical skill and gift of coming out with something that no one else has thought of and making it happen. We're going to show that that's just not the case, that innovation equals entrepreneurship and business. Part of the problem that with this notion that we've built up in the popular culture, a narrative of innovation where it's all around Silicon Valley, the tech industry, Apple computers, and all of these things, is that somehow we believe that innovation is only comes from a technology standpoint, and that's just not true as well. I mean, it's ironic that many of us who seek to be innovative try and copy that model, when underlying that model are really different principles and values that many of us hold. I mean, they're about making money. They're about creating code. They're about really the idea of making something cool for themselves. And I don't think that we all share those things in common, and every community has the same goal. So the other one is that making for all, that makerspaces and throwing a 3D printer in a corner of a library is going to somehow make it magically relevant to your community again. There is a false equivalency there. And that ultimately innovation is about technology. So let's go into these, and let's start with the notion that innovation equals big invention. There's the idea that innovation means coming up with something fresh and new, that you can have a great idea that no one else has thought about, you quickly run out and patent it or build it or something else, and that's innovation. And that if you're just taking something from somewhere else, that's just copying, it doesn't count. Well, in academia, we actually use these terms very specifically. Invention means to come up with something new. Innovation usually means a new application for an existing idea. And I want to give you three examples of them, and I hope they're somewhat fun examples of them, but we're actually living with them. And the first one I want to talk about is this guy. His name is Danny Biasone, and I love Danny. Danny is a Syracuse native. He went to Lemoyne College up here, and he owned one of the first professional basketball teams back before the NBA, and they were the Syracuse Nationals or Syracuse Nats. And Danny had a problem. And that problem was that basketball, back when he was talking in the early 50s and such, was really, really boring. I mean, really boring. There was no March Madness. They would come out with scores like things like 20 to 17. This was not a high-scoring game because at the time what happens is your team would get the ball. You'd shoot the ball. You'd go up on the clock. If you got the ball back, what you tried to do was sit there and hold it for as long as you can. Right? The idea wasn't necessarily to score lots of points. It was to prevent other people from scoring lots of points. And so it was a defensive game. So Danny didn't like this because it wasn't very exciting. He wasn't going to draw crowds. It wasn't an interesting use for the game. And he looked around and he found this interesting idea being used in some college games. And that was the notion that you give a team so many seconds, some time, with which they have to score the ball. They have to shoot or score the ball. And it was the shot clock. And so Danny looked at it and said, all right, how long is the game? I would really like each team to score about 80 points. So if that's 160 points divided by the amount of time in the game, that's about 24 seconds. And so he put a clock over his baskets, and he said, you have 24 seconds, the shot clock. If you come to downtown Syracuse, you will see the original shot clock as a lovely testament in downtown. And you have 24 seconds to hit the rim or get out. And it instantly changed the game. It did exactly what he wanted, which was it made the game more exciting to watch. But then something really, really interesting happened, which is the other part of innovation is we constantly think of it as something huge. It's got to be a big innovation. It's got to be the idea of taking our computer labs, putting up glass, totally changing the environment. It's got to, if we're going to innovate, it's going to have to involve rocket ships and laser beams, right? But what Danny said is, relatively small changes can lead to big ideas. So when he introduced the shot clock, suddenly it became an offensive game. Suddenly it became a much faster game. Suddenly it became about the idea of scoring, and that came into things like slam dunks, and it came into a much taller, faster athletic game. And at the same time, television networks were looking around for another sport to offer. Television had baseball online, which is really exciting for many people, and they were looking for the next game. And they found basketball. And so they began broadcasting basketball. That led to the NBA, that led to major contracts and deals, which led to billion-dollar industry around basketball, which has led to celebrity and March Madness and the whole thing. And while it's not 100% attributable, a lot of it began with a simple Danny sitting in the stands and wanting it to be more exciting. What that teaches me is when you try something, even if it's you think it's a small change or a small innovation or taking something from somewhere else and applying it, it may have really big consequences. Another sort of fun example. Have you ever wondered why the average pop song is 3 minutes long? That when you listen to Britney Spears or when you listen to Shakira or when you listen to J-Lo or what have you, that the songs are relatively short? I mean, you know, there are some of us who still, you know, we get into Rush and we have to listen to the entire album. But a lot of pop songs now are 3 minutes long. Why? Is it because people can't remember that many words or can't deal with that much exposure to people like Britney Spears? No. It began actually in the early recording industry when Edison and other people developed initial recording technologies. They worked on wax cylinders. So they had a mechanical system. You would yell into a big, in essence, cone. It would vibrate a diaphragm, which would etch the sound into plastic, into wax cylinders. And it turns out, for the amount of speed and fidelity, the amount of wax cylinders that they could produce at mass could hold about, ready for it, 3 minutes worth of music. And so what happened is while they went and tried to record operas and all classical music, they ended up with 50 different cylinders. And so popular writers and people began writing for this new medium. They began writing popular songs for 3-minute format, which led to the idea that pop songs were quick and fast. And even after we moved out of wax cylinders and into vinyl and into tape and into digital and whatever, people still got used to that form. What began as trying to develop a technical solution and coming up with technical limitations began influencing just about everything we do. At a 30,000-foot level, what I'm trying to say is sometimes it's our obstacles that become the greatest opportunity for innovation. How do we begin to deal with these different issues and problems can become an advantage. For example, back in the great burst of internet activity, 1998, 99, and 2000, when the internet was going to put out libraries out forever, the general sense was you have to be online, forget your buildings, they're useless, you've got to be where people are. And what we've found is that limitation, meaning we have a physical plant that states have put in requirements for a physical plant, we have these spaces, has now become the hub and community center and a great asset to us. What we built to house books turns out to be the same thing that we begin to build to house people and conversations and discussions and meetings of minds and communities. So what began as a solution of how do we bring a bunch of materials together turns out to be an innovation into how we bring communities together. The last example I'll give and then I move on is this notion of the credit hour. So if you, I heard before you're working on this to get CEUs and continuing education units. Did you ever wonder where the unit came from? If you have your master's in library science, you took a lot of 3-credit courses that went over a semester. Or you took 1-credit courses, or sometimes you took 5-credit courses, etc. Where does that credit come from? It originally had nothing to do with the amount of content that we offered. Today, many states, including Georgia, define credits around access time and how much face time you have and how much work and all these time measures, but that's not where it started. It started actually back in the early 1800s when universities offered courses, and courses weren't one course, they were your degree. If you were going to get library science, you just showed up and the professors would work with you until they said, done, and you're on your way. And it wasn't until some academics actually out of Harvard began the concept of an elective, that is, that you had the core, but then you could take these other courses and you could fit them into your course and that would enrich it. They were looking in medical school. So you became a doctor, but you could become a doctor around children, a pediatrician, or around cancer, an oncologist, etc. And they needed a way to structure that. And so they came up with the notion of a credit. And you go, oh, that's really interesting. Then everyone adopted it? No. Most universities said, that's crazy, that's stupid, that's not how we do it. And then it took something called the Carnegie Foundation, good old Andrew's bequest to the world, that said, you know what? We believe that teachers and academics do an important thing for society, and yet they don't really have a chance to get a pension and build up a retirement fund. So Carnegie created something called TIA-CREF, and if you've been in academia at all, you know that's mostly our retirement plan. But he said, in order for you to become part of this retirement plan, in order to get a couple of $1 million towards your retirement for your faculty, you must adopt the standard credit union and or credit unit. And so the whole notion of a credit hour in academia and what's a CEU and all that timing actually came from a bribe from the Carnegie Foundation to higher education to implement this because they believed in this notion of electives and they paid us off with retirement. And as an academic, I'm okay with that. Now, what's interesting is all of these lead to one other interesting part of innovation that we often ignore, and that is innovation is time sensitive. That what was innovative at one time can become the thing that holds us back now. That you almost have to have the right situation for something to occur. For example, that 3-credit hour thing is killing us now. When we look at the notion of moving people, like say library science, right? The notion that you have to be certified after you get a degree and licensure and et cetera, part of the limitations we run into is because we have to do it within so much time and it has all these other things. We know that the notion of continuing education must evolve into continuous education, where you're learning constantly, it's part of the job, and access to faculty and professors and each other. Right now, this idea that universities aren't deeply involved in continuing education because we're used to charging $1,000 to $3,000 per one of those credit hours, that innovation at the time is now limiting us to move forward. So we need to begin to look at how can we move beyond, and even though it was innovative yesterday, is it still useful today? So that's the first one, that innovation is has to be big and has to be invention. Innovation is adoption of good ideas and contextualization, putting it into your local setting. Both of those things matter. The next myth I want to take on is the notion that innovation equals entrepreneurship and business. That is, that when we talk about people being innovative and disruptive change and we read all this literature, we always migrate to the Elon Musk's, you know, biography and reading about Steve Jobs, and somehow it's all about money, money, money. And many public libraries in particular talk about, oh, we're going to be entrepreneurship centers. We're going to start businesses. So Meg Baucus, many years ago, who's right now working up in Alaska and is a brilliant person in general and a brilliant librarian, was part of a study. She was a graduate assistant on a study that Ruth Small and others did. And they went and looked at how do public libraries support entrepreneurship? How do they support business creation? And they found lots and lots of programs around the country where libraries say, well, yes, we help build businesses because that's what we're about. And they would say, all right, how do you do it? Well, we host meetings and we provide access to lawyers and we do seminars and we do workshops and we provide materials and databases and et cetera. And I said, that's great, that's great. And how has it worked? And what Meg found over and over and over again when she went to library after library is she said, how has it worked? The libraries would sit there and go, what do you mean? They were supposed to tell us that they started a business? Well, that's not our job. You're not worried about it. That there was all of this verbiage and all of this work and all this movement to starting businesses and supporting entrepreneurship and new business, but very little follow through. Even from the concept that if you go to a incubator startup, they get equity. In other words, they help you start your business and they get a return on investment. And libraries don't think that way, but they also don't think about how do we make this work and do we provide spaces and how do we value it. But Meg looked deeper and she said another interesting thing she noticed is that people would come to these big meetings, how to start your business, and there would be a huge crowd. And out of that crowd, after they talked about, you know, incorporation and finances and they talked about legal status and all this other stuff, very, very, very few of that crowd, like one out of 60, one out of 100, would actually move to start a business. And Meg looked at this and thought about this for a while, and she sort of realized what an opportunity was that many public libraries were missing. She says, you know, it starts, and innovation starts with an idea, right? So there's our light bulb. And by the way, you show this to most people, they have no idea what, you know, kids these days. Sorry, I just sounded like my grandfather. Don't know what this is, so we use this, and even that, they're not going to understand in 10 seconds. So now it's, you know, something they can change colors on. Someone comes up with an innovation, and our cultural narrative is, if you have a great idea, go start a business. Go make $1 million out of it. But many people have a great idea, but they're not that concerned about the money side of it, or they're afraid of the money side of it. Meg's idea was that if you move into sort of an entrepreneurship narrative, frame, model, thinking, that usually involves the notion of needing capital. That is, if you have a great idea, you need money to make it happen, to hire someone, to hire a programmer, to build something. You know, this is the Shark Tank view. Right? If you watch Shark Tank at all, it's all about people with a great idea who want to make a business. And the first question they have is, how much is it worth? How do you put money beside it? How are you going to get the money? And anytime you take on capital, what you're doing is you're taking on risk. And that level of risk, whether it's maxing out your credit cards, whether it's asking your parents for money, whether it's asking your kids for money, whether it's taking a loan out, whatever it is, that risk for so many people, including, by the way, most librarians, is such a high level that they never continue on it. They simply say, well, it's a good idea, but it's not worth me losing my house. It's a great idea, but I'm not going to quit my day job. And so what happens is libraries were there trying to push people into a mechanism that didn't actually fit a lot of the community that wanted to move forward. Now, to be clear, in some settings, it works beautifully. And there are many examples from Cuyahoga County to Chattanooga to literally Emporia, Illinois, that have done a great job of actually helping people start businesses. So that still makes sense for their local community. But she says what libraries are really good at is they're really good at networks. That is, if someone has a great idea, oftentimes they're more interested in implementing the idea than necessarily turning it into their life's work. And what they need access to is not necessarily capital. They need access to the multitudes. Now, what do I mean by that? Her words, great words. What she said was, imagine if you had a great idea for a website, but you don't know how to do a website. Well, it turns out there's lots of people on the internet that are willing to give you an hour or two to help you set up the internet. Or lots of people having the same problems. I want to start a blog. Gee, what software do we have available? Let's get a bunch of people together around open source software and we'll create something like WordPress, which now is, by some estimates, two out of every three websites on the internet is run out of an open source software called WordPress that came because a bunch of people like-minded put together an idea and made the software work. What we can do as librarians is someone comes, I have a great idea for a blood drive. I have a great idea for a book club. I have a great idea for starting a writer's group. I have a great idea for knitting. I have a great idea for gardening. Whatever it is, what libraries are really great at is saying, oh, did you know so-and-so also has that idea? And have you thought about this? And let's see if there's someone online to do it. What we can do is provide access to the multitudes, and we can begin to connect and help people implement their great innovations, not by putting themselves into debt, but by connecting them with other communities of interest. And she said, because on one hand, in the business world, you've got the marketplace, meaning the marketplace of commerce, vital, important, and a priority for some locations. But what public libraries are part of already and a good, important part of and linking mechanisms is the marketplace of ideas. We can help people with ideas get together. We have a place or a virtual place. We have a trust. We have connections. We have the skills and organizational skills to locate them and bring them together. And so the point being that innovation doesn't have to be about building businesses. Maybe that's what you want to do, but it can be about building solutions and ideas and communities. And there are places. I was working with the Free Library of Philadelphia. They said, we want to help start businesses, but we're right down the street from the Wharton School at Penn. We're not going to compete with them. And the answer was, well, Penn wants to start big businesses. We're happy if we start a butcher shop. If we can start a deli, if we can have someone do hairstyling out of their homes and use that as a second income, we consider that a success. And so once again, what does your local community need? What is it in rural Georgia or in Atlanta or in suburban Georgia or whatever? What does your community need? What do they want to build? Do they want to build a festival? Do they want to build maker cultures? Do they want to build businesses? And how can you support those and not think that every time a library talks about innovation, they're talking about starting businesses? Because that's what your community should help you determine their priorities. Next myth, that innovation equals making for all. So we as a community, as a library community, have some fabulous, fabulous things that are in our favor as a profession. We're well connected. We constantly are seeking and engaging our communities and looking for information. And so we're always out there sort of shopping for new stuff. And the idea of these kinds of virtual staff development days, the idea of continued licensure, we're getting better at sort of incenting our profession to constantly learn. One of the other things that libraries tend to do is we tend to want to be the second to do anything. Right? That a new idea is fantastic, but only after it's been proven somewhere else. And it also means that every so often, and I'm not implying that anyone either talking or listening does this, but we can be a bit into fads. You know, oh, it's the new thing, let's try that. Oh, it's Facebook, everyone get on Facebook. Oh, it's Twitter, everyone get on Twitter. Right now, somewhere, someone listening to this is busy thinking about Instagram of funny covers of books, and they want to do it. And that community, that may work. But one of the areas that we need to talk about is the maker culture. That the idea that innovation in libraries right now is all about 3D printing and laser etchers and the notion of having the ability to create democratized making. People can come and be their own manufacturer and invent new things. And this idea that if we throw a 3D printer or three 3D printers or whatever it is, we've become innovative. When in fact, if what we're doing is simply doing that because someone else did, we're not being innovative, we're just copying and implementing. If we know it fits our local community or if we modify it to our local community, then we can innovate. But if all we're doing is adopting because everyone else is adopting, I'm telling you, I've seen a lot of 3D printers with a lot of dust and some of them in closets because we all ran to that bandwagon and we didn't understand what we were really getting into. And one of the things that we talk about is the language around the maker culture, that innovation right now is about makers, that they produce their own designs, that they produce their own engineering, that they do all of this stuff on their own. This whole maker culture is very much built around the idea of a democratized view. If we just got this in the hands of kids in inner city, if we just got get this in the hands of school children, if we just got this in the hands of seniors, if we just, this technology is going to change the world because now everyone's going to make something. But if you actually look at the data around that, the truth of the maker movement, according to a survey conducted by Maker Media, which, by the way, runs Maker Magazine, which is frankly the sort of epicenter dialogue around the maker culture, 8 out of 10 makers are male. Their median age is 44. Their average household income is $106,000. Nearly 83% are employed and 31% have job descriptions that fall into science or engineering categories. 97% are college graduates and 80% have some postgraduate education. If you were to try and take a picture of what a typical maker looks like, it would look like me. And so we can use this language all we want, but are we truly fitting in the groups that we want? If we just get a 3D printer and put out, hey, we have a 3D printer, the kinds of people we're going to attract that are naturally attracted may already be a part of it will probably not look like all the people we want to serve. We have to use the technology. The innovation isn't simply that we bought it and placed it, it's that we contextualized it, that we have hacker camps for girls or underrepresented minorities, or we put these makerspaces not into our suburban libraries but into our urban libraries, or our makerspaces into rural libraries where they may not have access to them otherwise. It's not simply a matter of saying, oh, we buy the making thing. It's the idea that we believe these are tools that can be utilized to improve our communities, which means we must understand and have a very clear definition of what improve our communities means. It's all about context. It's all about making sense. Because I'll tell you, the story is if you just get a 3D printer and throw it in the corner, and by the way, I love 3D printing. It's great. But if you just do it, and anyone coming in will in seconds find something called Thingiverse. And Thingiverse has thousands and thousands, mostly breaking copyright and trademark, items that you can download and print. So you can print a little bust of Batman, and you can print a little bust of Iron Man, and you can print really cool, you know, things out of it. But what will happen is people will adopt it as a sort of second-rate Walmart. Oh, let's print this out. Not let's create, let's design, let's do 3D CAD design. Not this whole notion of making. It's just another way for them to consume. And they'll lose interest really quickly when they realize that the things that they come out of that 3D printer are not as nice as the things coming out of China, are not as nice as the things they can buy for cheap on Amazon. It's in the creation that it becomes interesting. There was just a story on NPR yesterday about a college graduate in New Jersey who loved 3D printing, and he also had crooked teeth. And so he figured out, he built his own sort of Invisalign braces over 12 months to straighten his teeth by taking a mold, printing it out in 3D, using 3D software to design what he wants his teeth to look like, and then coming up with 12 iterations and making these things. I went home and told my children they were clearly underperforming in the innovation world because I have to pay for their braces. My point being, that's cool. But that took someone who was innovative, and he was in a college setting, he had a degree. It was all about creation. What expectations do you build up for the people who come into your community? Or do you simply say, look, it's 3D printer, it must be cool. Why is it cool? How are we going to use it? What's going to happen? So innovation doesn't just mean making. Innovation means making that fits your local community. Farming is a form of making. North Onondaga Public Library has a library barn now. They have a library garden where they loan out plots of land and people grow. And you go, oh, that's interesting. I've heard that, right, because it was a trend. But what's interesting is that then come August, when everyone grew tomatoes and you have 50,000 tomatoes, and you're trying to, you know, like foist them off on friends and family, they began talking about farm to table, local food sourcing, food pantries. They built a whole mechanism to continue a dialogue. The scouts came in and did studies on how insects are essential to good farming. And so they built insect houses and they built platforms and they began a whole community around appreciating agriculture. They started a farmer's market on Saturdays. It became a whole mechanism that fit in a dialogue of their community, not simply another service to throw out there and hope someone looks at. And what I'm not going to say in here, but I want to be really clear, is that if you want as a librarian to feel like you're going to master every new trend that comes out, that you are going to be the main focus and impetus of every innovation that's implemented within your library, you have severely limited the capacity and capabilities of your library. Your communities represent a much greater idea and possibility and locus of innovation than your staff. Your job in many cases is not to innovate, but to facilitate innovation. Come back to that in a moment. And I'm just going to hit this one again, this notion that innovation equals technology, that all innovation is some unique implementation of a new piece of technology. And there's a lot to look at and say, oh, clearly. For example, we know, for example, that internet use over time by teens and adults, this is Pew's data, more and more people are connected. The days of talking about people without connectivity are not over by a long shot, but they're definitely changed. This notion that, for example, 12 to 17-year-olds, 95% of 12 to 17-year-olds in a national survey had access to the internet. Even if you look up to 65-plus, the seniors have moved from 20 to 52%, and they're growing more rapidly than any other category. So we can look at this and say, oh, if we do an app, if we do a cool web system, if we do a hackathon, if we invite people in and we want to have our community become more technologically literate, be it urban, rural, suburban, what have you, clearly this is what they need. But if you dig into those numbers deeper, if you break through those numbers, you find this sort of interesting tidbit. Much of this frenzy of access is facilitated by mobile devices. Nearly 3/4 of teens have or have access to a smartphone, and 30% have a basic phone, while just 12% of 13 to 17 say they have no cell phone types at all. And this is an amazing number. African American teens are the most likely of any group of teens to have a smartphone, with 85% having access to one, compared with 71% of both white and Hispanic teens. When's the last time you heard of an adoption of technology that had black teens leading the way? This is fabulous. This is an amazing, wonderful story. But does it truly become a platform for innovation? Once again, technology, having access to it, utilizing it, may have great things in terms of teaching, in terms of understanding, in terms of work and engagement, but does it necessarily mean that you have built a great platform for innovation? Because it turns out that there's one thing about a smartphone that many people don't think about, and that is all the apps you have loaded on your smartphone, from Angry Birds to Instagram to Facebook to email to what have you. You know the one thing you can't do with your smartphone? You know what the one thing that there is not an app for that? Building an app. Meaning that what we see here is that you can read this very much as African American teens are most likely to have a device that they cannot build for, control, or manipulate at the same level as people that have desktop machines, computers, and computer access. Why do we have computer terminals in our libraries? Is it just to let seniors come in and do training on word processing? No, it can be to let people with smartphones come in and be inspired to build their own app. And they need high-quality internet connection. They need development tools. They need software. They need support. They need training. That technology, simply having access, is insufficient. It's kind of like saying, oh, we have lots of books, therefore everyone in our community must be literate. Well, just because you have access to books doesn't mean you know how to read. Innovation isn't simply about a condition. It is about going through an implementation. It is about understanding that you've done it and you've been part of it. So simply saying that we're going to be innovative by adopting technology, you may well be adopting things that actually disenfranchise the communities you serve. Because if we're truly in the empowerment business, which means we're in the power business, There is no app to overcome the barriers of race, class, sexual orientation, and gender, and app building won't either. Don't think that if you have a rural community that is having an extraordinarily hard time moving through different classes, we just have great studies that talk about the idea that wealth is now tied to mortality rates. You're not going to make a poor community rich simply by saying, hey, look, there's an app for that. You've got to give them the tools to take power and control and build their own. And it's not just about technology. In Ferguson, when Ferguson, everyone loves to talk about, and I love to talk about because it is a brilliant and amazing story, when Ferguson Public Library is in the middle of protest and riots and racial strife, opened up and started a classroom. That was an innovation. It had nothing to do with technology. That was the least old school technology you can think of. They had a space and they brought teachers and students together and they said, we're a family and we're going to be safe. That was an innovation. Bravery was an innovation. In Baltimore, when after civil strife and racial strife and racial prejudice caused riots and caused destruction and caused anger to burst over after years and years of suppression, what most people don't understand is that when those riots occurred in downtown Baltimore, the citizens destroyed their access to food, to public facilities, to shopping of any sort, and there was no public transportation, which was part of what led to the protests. And so what did the library do? It's not that they said, oh, good, we're going to give you an app. Oh, we're going to give you internet access. What they did is they said, we are going to provide you legal services, and we're going to provide you diapers, and we're going to provide you public restrooms. The innovation that they provided based in their community's needs, not based on something flashy and fancy, it was based on what they needed today. What does your community need? We have to remember that public libraries were created out of a quest for social equity. It came out of the same thing that created public schools in this country. It was affiliated with the women's suffrage movement and representation and voting rights. It was a social movement that said, if we are going to be a country that governs ourselves, we must be informed. Our children need to come out of factories into our schools, and our factory workers need to have access to reading materials and democracy. That's our heritage. If we then turn around and find ourselves now an instrument of simply creating better consumers that can watch other people's movies on their devices, that can be secured and access all this other stuff, but we enhance this, we are in essence turning our backs on our heritage. Empowerment is not about technology. Empowerment is about finding out what communities need, what they aspire to, what they dream to do, and then, in a very contextualized way, finding the best means of making that happen, whether it's from another library, whether it's from a company or another country, whether it's from a 12-year-old or a 30-year-old, and making it available and accessible to our folks in an equitable way. Now, since we're on this topic of false equivalencies, there's two other areas I want to hit, and then we can hopefully have a good conversation. The first is that innovation in and of itself can lead to short-term gains, but without matching it with maintenance and continuing these things over time, you will ultimately create more problems and greater expectations than you can deliver on. This is a fascinating piece that I highly recommend at aon.co there. Hail the maintainers. Capitalism excels at innovation, but is failing at maintenance, and for most lives, it is maintenance that matters more. Right? When you're driving down the street and you see smart signage that tells you about how long it's going to be on your commute, but you're going through pothole after pothole that's breaking your axles, you get the difference between innovation and maintenance. We need both. So it's one thing to bring the 3D printer in. It's another to have classes that sustain it. And it's another than believing that librarians alone need to master that technology. You need to build that expertise and rely on your communities to do it. What's more sustainable, you offering a program on 3D printing or you bringing together an interested set of students and parents and seniors and businessmen and whatever and saying, here's some tools, you guys decide the ground rules. You play with it. You figure out where we can go with it. Because that kind of community connection over time will sustain itself. We're all about connecting people, our true collections. The other thing that I want to emphasize is that innovation must be across the entire organization. We can't have the innovative librarian, meaning, oh, we have 5 librarians or we have 30 librarians, but we've hired the innovative librarian. They're going to fix it. Their job is to do the things that get plugged in is really cool. We'll sit back and do what we've always done. It doesn't work that way. Innovation must be a culture. It must be about everyone being involved, not just librarians, but the administrators. Administrators have to learn to take risks and support risk and build into their assessments and evaluations and annual evaluations, did you try something that scared the hell out of you? Because if you didn't, then you're not stretching far enough, and I'm going to support you in doing it. But it goes beyond that, which is innovation, which, by the way, I'll take you way back at the beginning, doesn't have to be about massive changes. It can be about improving self-checkout or how to speed checking out of materials or how to create new displays of systems or how to bring coffee into a computer lab to make the atmosphere, right? Doesn't have to be huge. But we should take those suggestions from everyone. If your library spends money on librarians going and get training, wonderful, fabulous, amazing, good, keep doing it. But you also need to support your volunteers that are doing it, library aides, the secretaries. You need to support the entire library culture. Because when a community member comes in and they say, gee, I have a crazy idea, you want anyone that they see, staff, volunteer, administrator, another patron, whatever, you want anyone that they see go, oh, that's cool, let's make it happen. You want a culture that says it's about trying to make life better. And everyone's job is about trying to make life better. So if you have training session, you bring in a consultant, you do hackathons, you do surfing, you do whatever you want, make sure that everyone in your organization is in that room. Not just one librarian, the new librarian, the librarian who doesn't do the reference desk, everyone. The volunteer, the staff member, the teenager who keeps showing up on Thursdays because they want something to do. It's all about culture. Innovation is not a thing. It is not an event. It is a cultural belief that we must constantly adapt and try to make things better. And some things are as good as they're going to be for now. But what about tomorrow and the day after? It's about then maintaining and holding on to things, but also realizing that after 30 years, sometimes the greatest thing that an old innovation can give you is the courage to try a new innovation. And what I mean is that many of us have started a service or a new thing that we loved, and it's been going for 15 years, and we don't have the capacity to try something new because we keep doing this thing that we've been doing for 15 years, and we're going to stop doing that thing. And people go, oh, we can't because, you know, that was so cool in the day. It was not that the thing that we're going to discontinue has no value or had no value. Its value is that we showed that we can change and improve constantly. That what we want people to feel ownership of, that we want people to feel territorial, is not in the innovation, but in innovating. That they should feel that they have the capacity to think of new things all the time. So, with that, that's my brief discussion that the core of what librarians do is innovate. What we seek to do is learn constantly, and we seek to help our communities learn constantly. We seek to improve, we seek to aspire, we seek to dream, and that means at the core we innovate. And as librarians, we have a unique position and obligation to make sure that innovation reaches across every end of our community, and that we must maintain those things over time, which gives us a status that just about no other organization in the world has. The fact that you've been in your community for 50 years, 150 years, means that you have something that many other organizations don't. You have a history of maintaining this learning exercise, and we need to continue that. All right. Questions, comments, thoughts? Put them here in the Q&A panel. How do you determine what your community needs? Great question. Let us realize, first of all, that what we need to do as librarians and as, you know, users of public resources, and if we have academic libraries, users of tuition resources, users of resources of our communities, we must be good stewards of those. That means that we need metrics. But we have to understand that those metrics are really negotiations of value. So the years of circulation counts, of gate counts, of looking at people who walk in and out of the building, of hits on the website, These are simply quick shorthands for negotiating, are we doing the right thing? What we need to understand is have conversations with our communities. That can be everything from focus groups to regular surveys, but a lot of it means getting out of your building. The buildings are really community tools, and not so much librarian tools anymore. We don't need as much space to do what we used to do. And so we can spend a lot more time at community centers, sitting in chambers of commerce, sitting in arts councils, sitting in discussions and meetings with United Way organizations. Lots of different examples, but it comes down to being at places of conversation, listening for a long time, and when you can then contribute, oh, did you know so-and-so is also working on that? How can I connect you together? It's in essence reference work. Now, Jamie LaRue used the phrase community reference, but it's the same idea of having librarians out within the community seeking out what people are doing. And so get out of the building and get to where the community congregates and see what they're doing. Maybe there's nothing you can do there, but maybe there's lots of ways you can participate and be part of it. How can Aquaman... Hi, Steve. Let's see. How can Aquaman innovate to become a better superhero? Well, they started. My favorite podcast is Circulating Ideas. It's absolutely true. And we'll leave that one there. You know, it's always someone. The maintenance question is an important one. Once again, I think the major locus of innovation in a community should be the community members. And oftentimes librarians ask me, what is my value? When someone comes in and they want to start a reading group, they want to start a gardening club, they want to start a new business, what have you. I'm not a gardener, an expert, an engineer, whatever. What value can I provide? Why would they come into the library or ask librarians assistance for this? The short answer is that librarian skill set, and I'm not talking about the idea of being able to slap plastic around a book and a barcode on it. That is an outcome of a skill set of organization, of maintenance, of preservation. One of the things is we sit in way too many meetings in our life, but it turns out that we actually know how to organize a meeting, or at least we know how not to organize a meeting. We can provide that due diligence, the infrastructure to make something happen. If you're going to have a manga club that begins collecting resources, you know how to maintain those resources over time and electronically. You can talk about, for example, how to buy resources in a much more efficient way than everyone buying their own. Talk about group values and pricing. So a lot of the skills that we have that we look at right now focused around collection and circulation, if we focus that around community activities and innovation, those skills directly translate. They really do. This idea of how you organize information, how you distribute information, how you preserve information over time, how you solicit ideas and questions and match those to resources and match resources together, just put people in front of information resource, and that's what we really have been doing all along. How can libraries better communicate their value to funding agencies? There's a strategic and a tactical answer. The strategic answer is you need to engage with your boards on a regular basis to question what numbers are collected and why. You need to work with the state library and state library about why are we collecting these resources? Does it make sense? Which the answer may be yes. But let's not treat them like they exist forever and always. These are, once again, negotiated markers of value. So let's get our markers of value right. Do we want to, instead of counting how many books went out, how many people sat down at events? Do we want to talk about not how many people checked out books, but how many have library cards? Whatever those values are, that's a strategic use. Penetration is actually the new metric we should be working on. How much penetration do we have within our community? How much do they know about us? How much do we know about them? The more tactical level is we need to get out of the number game. And I mean that as in measures. Eli Nyberger, who's at the Ann Arbor District Library, points out, does a great job. He says, if you begin reporting these static metrics, circulation, visits, etc., they're going to naturally fluctuate from year to year. So some years you're going to have up and some years they're going to be down, and it becomes a horse race. And the people oftentimes, when they have these metrics from year to year, miss the trends. He prefers, and I agree with him, we need to look at what are called scalar or comparison metrics. So if you haven't done it, go look at and find the infographic that talks about in New York City, more people went to a public library than all New York sporting events, including the Yankees, the Mets, and the Knicks combined. That tells you the magnitude of something, as opposed to we had this many people. So think about comparison metrics. How many people are engaged and involved in the library versus how many people go to a museum or how many people take advantage of XYZ company? How much material is circulated for your area from you versus Amazon, etc.? Think about these idea of comparisons, because people have a hard time nailing numbers down. They want them, but they have a hard time sort of putting them in context. People are naturally much better at comparison metrics. Oh, we're doing better than, you know, Applebee's down the road. Oh, we have, you know, the same level of performance and engagement as our local school systems, et cetera. Give them some measure that shows the larger scale of what you do and spend a little less time on the day-to-day numbers that are going to naturally fluctuate and draw people's attentions. Kim Silk also has a wonderful phrase. She says, you need data to tell good stories, and you need good stories to make the data real. Never put out a number without a narrative, right? So the idea that, oh, our circulation is down 10%, that's just a number. People are going to read it however they want, mostly negatively, as opposed to our circulation is down 10% because we focused on engagement in these different activities as can be seen by X, Y, or Z. You need narratives. You need stories. Your annual reports and evaluation shouldn't just be table after table. It should be picture after picture of the people's lives that you've affected. And there is innovation to be done in reporting and metrics. Right, just looking for good ones here. I work in a system that equates innovation with technology with youth. Yes! Library shuts out better qualified, experienced, and tech-savvy librarians on the basis of the stereotype. Could you address the issue of age discrimination in innovation? Yes, it sucks, and it's stupid. I know some of the most technologically advanced people are people way older than me. It comes down to context and contextualization. The other thing is I do this really quick, easy technique to demonstrate that. We have freshmen that come in, and we're an information science program. So these are, you know, frankly, they're techies, slightly nerdy, and they come in and we get all, you know, 300 of them in a room. And I say, all right, everyone who has a smartphone, raise their hand. All of them go up. All of them go up. Because, you know, the youth these days, they do the Facebook. They know the internets. And you say, all right, how many of you spend an hour a day on your phone on the internet? How many of you an hour a day using your phone to connect, to update status, to send pictures, etc.? Just about every hand goes up. All right, 2 hours. A couple hands come down. 3 hours. About half the hands come down. 4 hours. The brave people sit there. By the time you get to 6 hours, one person, just because they're a pain in the ass, keeps their own. And then you look at them, you go, well, you realize that if you have a smartphone, you are on the internet 24 hours a day. That Apple knows where you are. Google knows where you are. They even know what you're doing. They have the idea of knowing if you're up or down. Are you moving? Are you standing? Are you working in different places? What apps are checking in? What data is going on? That represents the idea that youth may have a better affinity for technology, usually because they have more time to spend playing with the technology, but not necessarily a greater understanding of technologies. And one thing that we as a profession have to be very, 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 very worried about is when we as a profession ignore our deepest values and principles, particularly in promoting our deepest values and principles for adoption of something that seems cool or the kids like the internet. We've done this with ebooks. We push people to a system that tracks what they read in direct violation of our principles of privacy and confidentiality. We have rolled out technologies that in plain open text over the internet tell you who you are, what you're reading, what page, and what time without having truly evaluated it. That's not a matter of being old or young. It's a matter of being smart or not smart. And so what I can say is it has nothing to do with age. It has everything to do with attitude and preparation. And so a lot of, and I can take blame here too, library science programs, continuing education programs, we focus a lot on the new, because that's the thing that's most obviously changing, when in fact we need to spend a lot more time on the implication of this maintenance and how does the new reflect against our principles. You know, we're having a session. Miguel does a great job. What I love about his work at ALA is he talks about trends, but he doesn't just say, oh, here's a trend, it's cool, it's fancy. He really does look at, all right, here's a trend, here's some of the thinkers behind it, here's a briefing, here's a context, let's think deeper about that topic. And we need to be doing that more and more in our libraries, and that has nothing to do with age. It has everything to do with attitude, and that comes back to this notion of, do you want to innovate and change and make things better? Or do you simply want to play with something and walk away? Play is important, but at some point, play has to turn into aspiration, impact, working forward. Thank you again. I think I'm now 2 minutes over time, but thank you again for putting up with me, and I appreciate your time and look forward to the rest of your day.